Thank you all very much for coming this morning. Welcome back to Amherst. I'm David Perlmutter. I'm a Senior Development Officer here at the college, and I'm delighted to introduce our speaker today, our Dean of the Faculty and Winkley Professor of History, Catherine Epstein. Dean Epstein holds degrees from Brown University, the London School of Economics, and a little-known institution about 90 miles from here in Cambridge, Mass. You may have heard of it, Harvard. She's been at the college since 2000, specializing in modern German and Central European history. Since coming to Amherst, she's taught a wide range of European history courses, including courses on the Holocaust, Nazi Germany, World War II. And she's the author of four books on German history. Since July 2014, she's been the dean of the faculty. And I'm delighted to tell you that as of July 1 of this year, she will become provost of the college. Today, Dean Epstein will speak about academic initiatives, pedagogical innovation, and the changing faculty, among other things, I'm sure. And I believe she'll be happy to take your questions as well. So please join me this morning in welcoming Dean of the Faculty, Catherine Epstein.
All right, good morning. It's great to see so many of you here this morning. I think we've got to get down this screen. Sorry, I can't see some of you. I realize that. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk for sort of maybe 15 minutes or so, and then we're going to have a conversation. So I'm going to give you lots of information about what's going on at the college, demographic trends, and other things, and then we'll have a conversation. And I really look forward to your questions. Getting questions from Amherst alumni is about as good as getting questions from students in class, so it's a good thing. So Amherst right now is really in the midst of a transition. We are facing very new times. We have new students and we have new faculty. When I talk about the new times, what I'm talking about is students today have grown up in a very different environment, particularly around the digital world. And it's very easy to get information. That's not the problem. The problem is really interpreting the information. So, and it's also, students are very kind of hooked on screens and devices. So this is a different world in which professors are entering. That's one thing that's new. Another thing that's new is Amherst has long had a commitment to opportunity and access, but it's redoubled that effort. And so we have a more diverse student body, diverse in many different ways than we did in the past. And another thing that's quite different is that Amherst, like all basically all institutions of higher education in the United States today, is seeing a very dramatic turn towards the sciences. So many, many more students are now majoring in the sciences than was the case before. So I'm going to talk about these different themes. I'm going to start with our students. So the incoming class of 2023, 46% of that class will be domestic students of color. 22% of that class, and there's some overlap, but not entirely overlap here, will be Pell eligible. So Pell eligible students come from the lowest income brackets in the United States. And again, the sort of emphasis on Pell eligible students reflects a tradition that Amherst has of access and opportunity for all students. Amherst, after all, was founded for the sons of relatively indigent ministers, and it was intended to support those less well-off young men in 1821. And you see reflections of that tradition all the way up to today. Continuing this, 13% of students are first-generation students. That is, neither of their parents went to college or finished college. So that's different. On the other hand, average SAT scores. So the average SAT score combined math and English is 1476 on a 1600 scale, and the average ACT is 33 out of 36. How many of you would have gotten into Amherst today with those scores? I'm not seeing all that many hands going up, so keep that in mind. This is an academically extremely talented class, as are all our classes, and what's interesting is that we're able to maintain that level of academic standard even though we are broadening dramatically the demographic groups among whom we are recruiting. So the numbers are impressive, but the students are even more so. So when we start to talk about faculty, What we're seeing is a turnover in the faculty that's been slow. It's been going on for the past 10 to 15 years. We have a faculty now of 189 tenure lines. So there are 189 tenured or tenure track professors. Beyond that, we have another 50 or 60 lecturers or visitors in any given year. So when I talk about the faculty, it's a teaching faculty of roughly 250 people, but of those, 189 are regular tenure line faculty. So of those 189, 49 tenure line faculty have been at Amherst for 5 years or less. Okay, so almost a quarter, or about a quarter of the faculty has been here for a very short period of time. And that's to say that almost 40% of all tenure line faculty have been hired since Biddy Martin became president in 2011. So very dramatic. I mean, I've been on a hiring spree. Last year, not this academic year, but last academic year, we hired 19 tenure line faculty. And this year it was more normal. It was sort of, I think, about 10 or 12. So on the other hand, 47 faculty members have been here 30 years or more. So that's kind of interesting, right? So almost as many faculty have been here for 30 years as more as have been here for 5 years or less. And of course, the remainder, roughly half of the faculty, have been here somewhere between 5 and 30 years. We have an increasingly diverse faculty. A few years ago, 17% of our faculty were faculty of color. Today, the number is 23% faculty of color, and we are working very hard to increase that number and to do so by hiring the best faculty that we can across the board for our college. So Amherst remains very committed to providing a stellar, rigorous education. I think many of us, when we think of an Amherst education, what we're thinking of, it's excellent, it's rigorous, it's challenging. But I think what's happened in the past sort of decade or so, it's hard to note these things exactly, is that we're thinking not only challenging, but also supportive. So in the old days, and maybe I'm making that up, professors were really interested in how they were teaching and a little bit less concerned about what students were learning. And I think now there's a real shift where faculty members are really interested in what students are learning. And in order to really make sure that students are learning well, it takes an enormous commitment from the faculty. And what we're finding is all sorts of ways in which the Amherst faculty have sort of redoubled their dedication to teaching undergraduates and making sure that all of those students are able to be successful at the college. So when I hire people, what I say to them is, we're looking for professors who are challenging but supportive. You've got to be really challenging in the classroom, and at the same time, you have to be really supportive. That could involve changing pedagogical styles. It also involves an enormous commitment to office hours. So a year or two ago, I sent over an inquiry to the math department and asked, how many hours do most of your faculty members spend in office hours? And I got back the response, which was, all of us spend at least 10 hours a week in office hours. That's a lot of office hours per week per faculty member. Generally, you know, in the past when I was teaching, I would do 2 to 3 hours of office hours a week, and then, of course, by appointment. But the fact that we have numerous professors on campus who are doing, you know, 10 hours a week or more of office hours is, again, an incredible symbol or fact of our faculty's commitment to our students. So in order to make sure that our faculty are sort of supportive of students, we are undertaking a bunch of initiatives. So some of it is, of course, hiring new faculty who have often at their universities had access to graduate student training, that sort of thing. That was much less common a few decades ago. Now, younger faculty expect that kind of infrastructure. They've had it at universities where they got their degrees, their graduate degrees, but they haven't, but at the liberal arts colleges, it has not been so common to have a Center for Teaching and Learning. We now have a Center for Teaching and Learning. It's very tiny. It basically has 2 full-time staff members, but they do an awful lot of work with faculty members on a sort of one-on-one basis about how those faculty members can create and apply the kinds of teaching and pedagogical techniques that they'd like to do. In general, there's a real focus, not only at Amherst, but more broadly, but also at Amherst, around active learning and less lecturing and much more active discussion. So what we find is that in the past, for example, the introductory economics class or the introductory psychology class might have had somewhere between 100 and 200 students in the class. And everyone was packed into Merrill, probably, and had a lecture from a professor, and that was normal. Now, it's very rare to have that. Both economics and psychology have actually limited their introductory classes to 40 students each, which means that we run multiple classes of introductory economics or introductory psychology, but it's a much more interactive class, and there's much more, you know, the professor obviously knows everyone in the class, likely with the 100 or 200 kids, the professor knew the names of every student, but now it's a different sort of situation where faculty really know those students, and also there's a more of an emphasis on sort of active learning. There's a lot more emphasis on group learning. There's a sense that group learning, when you have to actually be responsible to your peers, that may be the best pressure in terms of learning. In other words, you may not want to turn in a paper to me, but you're going to want to turn, not let your classmates down. And so lots of emphasis on group learning, and that proves to be often quite effective. Many times, we professors take prompts, you know, like paper topics for granted and sort of assume, well, go write a 20-page paper on X. But in fact, students today often have no idea, how do you go about writing a 20-page paper on X? And so what we're doing is having professors do many more scaffolding exercises. So instead of saying, your 20-page paper is due at the end of the semester, instead what's happening is, 5 weeks into the semester, you have to give me the topic. What is your paper actually going to be on? What is the question that you're actually going to answer? And then later, you know, you turn in a bibliography, and then later you have to turn in the introduction, or you have to turn in some section of the body of the paper. And so the point is that this becomes much more transparent what it is that students are actually supposed to be doing. And I think in general, we often don't realize that students don't understand, and so there's a real effort to kind of make assignments much more transparent so students understand what they're doing. We have much more focus on student research, and this is interesting. I know some alumni do not like the idea of Amherst professors working on their research because they often think, well, that means they're not interested in undergraduate teaching, it means they're not doing teaching, but in fact, it's very much the opposite. We have to have professors doing cutting-edge research because we want to bring the students into that research. And you'll notice now, I mean, I just happen to be going over a bunch of job ads for next year's hires, and what I see is this line about researchers need to have a research program that is that makes use of undergraduate students in the research. So the point is, you're not at Amherst really doing research just to, you know, separate from the student body. Otherwise, you're not just going off into your ivory tower and doing it, but you're doing it with students and with undergraduate students. We believe really strongly in research, and that research fosters the skills that will be really necessary for tomorrow's work world. With research, you don't know the answers. There are no pat answers. You have to try things many times. You may not get it right the first time, then you do it a second time. It teaches a lot about grit and perseverance and keeping at it. It teaches a lot about creativity. It's like you've got to get out of the box to figure out the problem. It's not spoon-fed to you. So there are many, many reasons why the emphasis on research is something that everyone should be embracing, and we are doing a lot to make research opportunities available to students during the summers. We're doing a lot to try and get research incorporated more into regular class assignments. So the emphasis on research is really important. Another thing that we've done, that I've done really, is started a program of course-related travel. So students in a course of, say, up to 12 students will then, as part of the course, perhaps during spring break or right after the end of the semester, go abroad with the professor and the students. I think this is incredibly wonderful because many of the closest friends that I've made, I've actually made in these sorts of situations where you're together 24/7, and in fact, and you're also bonding over an intellectual interest. So we've had great success with the small numbers of students that have gone on these trips. Last spring, for example, we sent 12 kids to Istanbul with two professors. And the anecdotal evidence and what students write about these trips is phenomenal. And this semester we sent kids to opera, to Austria in order to study opera, again with two Amherst College professors, one a music professor and one a German professor. The reason why I think these sort of group experiences that are very intense are really important is that we have this enormously diverse student body, but we don't have anything that binds them together. And so when you create opportunities where students have to engage, I think it works. And so what's striking to me when I get back these sort of evaluation forms about these classes is how students say, this was a phenomenal intellectual experience, but what I really loved most was that I got to bond with students who I never thought I would bond with. I got to make friends with people I never imagined that I would be friends with. And that's really a fundamental goal of the college. Undoubtedly, someone in this room is going to ask about the open curriculum, and we can talk about the open curriculum because, of course, you would think, well, why don't you just do a core curriculum, and then you'll force students to bond over intellectual passions. I think the problem is, and we can talk about this more if it interests you, is those students who are doing core curricula are often not feeling like that's what they want to be doing. And so the beauty of these kinds of courses where students really are invested in the material is that they are really invested in the material. But we can talk about that later. Okay, I wanted to talk a little bit about initiatives geared toward the first generation and low-income students. Again, I gave the numbers a couple of minutes ago, but we have been doing a summer bridge program for about the past 20 years, but we've been expanding it gradually every year. And now what we do is we invite roughly 50 students to a three-week summer bridge program. We now have three tracks, one for the humanities, one for the social sciences, and one for the natural sciences. And the students are here on campus for 3 weeks. It is somewhat important in terms of closing the gap between how students who were at less well-performing high schools, the information that they learned, but that's not really the point of the program because in 3 weeks you cannot make up what students didn't get over 12 years of education, or 13 years of K-12 education. What the program does is really familiarize students with the college and what it means to be a college student at Amherst, and there's a lot of emphasis on building relationships with your faculty members, going to office hours, learning about all the resources available at the college. We have now also said that all of those 50 students then get what we call intensive advising, where they have a faculty member who's an advisor who meets with them roughly twice a month over the course of the first year. And this, we've been having really good results. So it's interesting, not a single student last fall or the fall before was on academic warning over the course of the fall semester. That is a new good thing for us. In the past, we've always had students who were on some kind of academic warning. That is not the case. We're really able to intervene with students very early on and, again, try and make them be successful. Last year, we had our inaugural Mickeljohn Fellows Program. So the Mickeljohn Fellows Program is for all students who come from families that can make only up to a $5,000 parental contribution. And all of those students get a funded summer opportunity through the Loeb Center for Career Exploration and Planning. And the idea is that these students can use a leg up. Their families may not have the connections that are necessary in order to get internships or other kinds of opportunities over the summer, and so the college wants to provide that to them. It is intended to force those students, so to speak, to engage with the Loeb Center for Career Exploration and Planning. And unsurprisingly, it's been very successful because something like 85% of the Mickeljohn Fellows have, in fact, engaged with the Loeb Center, and many of them are making use of their paid summer opportunity the summer after the first year, which is great because it just puts them on a trajectory to get other and better internships as they move through their Amherst years. We also have more staff support for students who come from less well-resourced backgrounds. We are doing a lot to try and even, so to speak, the playing ground here at the college. A little example, at the Career Center, we now have a clothing closet, so students don't have to go out and buy, you know, an expensive suit or formal wear that would be necessary for an interview. Instead, they can borrow the clothing. And my sense is this is working really well. So I'm going to turn now to curricular trends of our students. There is no question that there is a trend towards STEM. 37% of the class of 2019 had at least one major in the sciences or math. That is way up from 10 or 12 years ago. 10 or 12 years ago, about 17% of students were STEM majors. So it's a big difference. Unfortunately, this year, we went from 51% of the class of 2019 being humanities majors in 2018 to 48% of the class. We really want to make sure that the humanities stay strong at Amherst. So this is a concern. I'll talk about this in a minute. But we really, you know, we're glad that the number is as high as it is. 48% of the class of 2019 had at least one major that was a humanities major. I believe that is higher than any select liberal arts college across the country. There are some colleges like Carleton or Pomona that are below 20%. So these are good numbers given the general trends, but we're concerned about it. I'm concerned about it. 45% of the class of 2019 double majored. A couple, I can't remember, two or three, maybe had three majors, and one had four majors. That's the first time ever a quadruple major. The five top majors are really interesting. Math. The math department had the largest number of majors with 74 majors. This is unbelievable because, again, 10 or 12 years ago, it was like 5 or 10 students graduated in math. But now it's the largest major on campus. Economics had 73 students, so again, economics remains very strong in terms of majoring. Psychology, 54 students, computer science, 52 students, and English, 41 students. So again, the numbers are very clear sort of where student interest is going, but you know, there are many more humanities majors, so even though some of those majors have lower numbers, in the end, there are still, at least in the class of 2019, 48% of students majored in the humanities. I would also say that because we have this open curriculum, what I'm ultimately more concerned about are the numbers of enrollments. And there, the enrollments in the humanities remain strong, but there are issues, which I'll get to in a minute as well. So, So the problem is that we have many fewer faculty members in STEM than we do in the humanities or the social sciences. The social sciences I'm less worried about because that sort of maps sort of enrollment trends. So the social science classes in general aren't that much larger than they should be, but the STEM classes often are much larger than they should be. And we're starting to face a situation where you're almost at two different Amherst. If you're a humanities student at Amherst, you're in classes with 15 to 20 students, or sometimes even fewer students. On the other hand, if you're in STEM, you're in classes that are routinely 30, 40, and higher. And so that's a different kind of experience, and it's not really the liberal arts experience that we promise to students. So what we are wanting to do is actually to grow the faculty a little bit. We grew the student body by about 200 students starting in the, 2005, 2006, 2007, sometime in there. And what we found is that some majors in the humanities have exactly the same number of majors. So history has remained remarkably consistent across the board, roughly 40 majors every year. What's different, though, is that there are more students, and so history hasn't taken any more students. It's just remained constant. So a humanities faculty member at the college may not notice much difference in workload in terms of numbers of students and papers that they're grading and that sort of thing. On the other hand, all the growth, all the sort of new student enrollments based on growing the student body has all landed on the STEM side of things. And those faculty members are really feeling it and feeling it hard. So our goal as part of the Promise campaign is to raise the number of professors at the college, and for the moment, we would expect those lines to go to the sciences. I just wanted to mention one other thing about our commitment to the humanities. Amherst has an amazing humanities tradition, and part of what I'm interested in doing is sort of branding the college as the writing college. Here we are, you know, the home of Emily Dickinson. We own, as a college, the Emily Dickinson Museum. We own the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C. We have The Common, a literary magazine that has an enormously effective internship program where many, many students are going through that internship program. We have a great creative writing program. We have wonderful special collections and archives around writers. There's the whole tradition of Robert Frost. And many other, you know, famous authors who came out of Amherst. We have a really successful Lit Fest every late March or early April, where we bring really well-known authors to the college and sort of celebrate creative writing and non-creative writing, sort of writing over a period of 3 days. And we love this program, and we just want more and more students to really, you know, make use of those resources at the college. So we have a few new majors and programs of interest. In the past decade, we've set up an environmental studies department. We have a film and media studies program. Our newest major is Latin American and Latinx studies. We are in the process of possibly coming up with majors around education studies and perhaps Asian American studies, but both of those are some years away from actually being put into practice or put into effect. Again, we have a campaign, the Promise campaign, that's going on with $625 million as its goal. Much of what we're hoping that campaign will cover is growth in the faculty. Also, resources for pedagogical innovation, so more support for the Center for Teaching and Learning, for our Writing Center, for our Quantitative Skills Center. We are very interested in more resources for the Loeb Center to help transfer the Amherst education to the world beyond. One of the things we've already managed to accomplish through the Promise campaign is the establishment of the Charles Hamilton Houston internship program. So this is an internship program where we're going to build many more relationships with alums and others so that those individuals have internships available for Amherst College students. There are, of course, other really important goals for the campaign. Mostly financial aid, providing access for our students. That's just crucial in order to have the kind of talented student body and diverse student body that we have today. We need to have very robust financial aid. We always have facilities needs. There is an unbelievable office crunch for faculty members, and because of the way we've changed our teaching, there's a real crunch on classroom space as well. And we are very interested in creating a student center as a way to kind of help bridge divides and the campus and create spaces where students can interact more informally, but sort of in a way that they will do so. Finally, sustainability remains a really important campaign goal. So I'm going to stop there. I hope I've given you lots of sort of food for thought and start taking your questions. And hands already up. Yes. So you are correct. There is no mandatory retirement age in the state of Massachusetts. That may also be a federal law. I'm not sure about that. So we have a very effective phased retirement program. So once a faculty member signs that program, you can be on phased retirement for up to 10 years, depending on your age. It is financially very attractive and financially very attractive for the college. And so as a result, we've seen enormous turnover. I wouldn't have been able to hire the sort of 40 people that I've hired since becoming dean in 2014 unless people were retiring. So as soon as you sign your phased retirement agreement and you have reached the age of 62, your full-time equivalency, that FTE, becomes part of the pool that we can then reallocate. And so that means we also have more professors around because of that. Some of those dinosaurs are really amazing. So I don't want to say anything bad about the dinosaurs. They are quite amazing dinosaurs, and we also make sure that they can teach. I mean, if someone's really getting on, we don't have anyone in the classroom who I'm not confident can't teach, and I would say something to them. Yeah.
STEM major, not a single humanities course. My stepdaughter went to Vassar. No open curriculum. She's never taken a course in history that I know of since she was about 15 years old. She never took a course in her life in European history. Is that satisfactory? What is the matter with having some kind of distribution requirement?
So let me get to some of the numbers. It is impossible to be a science major at the college without taking humanities courses, largely because the science courses are so demanding in terms of hours in the classroom that just doesn't work. So every science student is taking some humanities courses, although often fewer than we would like. On the humanities end, the students who major in the humanities, roughly 25% of those never take a course in the sciences. It's going down. All right, so I have the head of institutional research right here. So a few years ago, it was 25%. It may be down to 15 or even 10%. 10%. Okay, so it's gotten a lot lower. And again, it speaks to the talents of our students, because in order to get into Amherst, based on the SAT scores I mentioned, you have to be good pretty much at everything. So every student who gets into the college is certainly able to take all of the courses at the college. What's wrong with distribution requirements? If I were founding a new college, I might well have a core curriculum, but I'm not. I'm living in a place that has a culture and that has decades of tradition and that has a faculty that is used now to the open curriculum. We've had an open curriculum for almost 50 years, so starting in 1971. I think what people or what faculty really value in their students, among other things, is that they are in their classrooms because they want to be. Right, there are no students in one's classes, particularly in the humanities, if they don't want to be. No one's forcing you to be there. Everyone is really, you have 800 courses to choose from at Amherst. You can only choose 8 a year. If you want to take a course in X, you're taking that course because you want to. That is not entirely true on the STEM end, because individuals who want to go to med school or follow certain career paths do need to take some classes that they really would prefer perhaps not to take but have to take. But that's for later. So what's so bad about it? So, I think you could make an argument that distribution requirements would be okay. I'm not sure that I'm seeing great value from distribution requirements at other institutions. And then you had your question about European history. Obviously, I'd love everyone to take courses in European history because I think it's phenomenal. But I don't think it's the end of the world if someone hasn't taken a course in European history. I think what's important is that we teach people how to think. And I think you can do that through a wide variety of classes at the college. And I don't believe that to be an educated person, you have to have covered a particular content. I see younger people nodding their heads in agreement and older people say, I don't think so. I don't agree with that. But that's fine. Yeah. Yes.
You alluded to this a bit about the diversity Michigan or the University of Massachusetts just because it's popular with a subset of people wanting to come here. Because it also does dilute the common experience, as is mentioned.
So the way that FTE, so professorial lines, are allocated is that a faculty committee does that. And they take a number of things into account. One is, you know, how important, you know, do we feel comfortable being a college without having an anthropologist of Africa? Right now we don't have an anthropologist of Africa, but are we comfortable with that? You know, we need, in some cases it is about course enrollment, so we have pretty much doubled our math department in response to student demand. So there's some of that. The Asian American Studies right now is really interesting because there are a group of students who are really eager to have more courses in that area, and they should. 14% of our students are Asian American, but the Asian American experience should be relevant to all of us, and all of us should be interested in learning about, you know, the experiences of many different Americans. The problem is that those courses are not hugely subscribed, so people want to have the opportunity to take them but don't necessarily take them. And so that becomes a dilemma. How much can we do that? So everything is sort of partially a response to enrollments, partially a response to changing interests. One of the things that departments always want is they want to replace whatever they had, and then they want to also add a line. And we can't do that, right? We are a small college. And on the other end, to students, what I say is, you know, if you've chosen to come to a liberal arts college, you have, by definition, chosen to come to a place where not everything will be covered. And I can give the example of my son, who goes to Kenyon College in Ohio, where they have no Jewish studies or one professor in Jewish studies, and they do not teach Hebrew. He had no opportunity to learn Hebrew at college. I didn't know he would want to learn Hebrew. I don't think he knew he would want to learn Hebrew, but that, you know, he couldn't, so he had to go to Middlebury over a summer in order to learn Hebrew. But the point is, by making the choice to go to a liberal arts college, you do make that kind of a choice, and I think what's important is just to be upfront with students about it. And they're, you know, we're lucky that we're in the five colleges, and so you can take Hebrew not at Amherst College, but at UMass or at Smith. And it's we're extremely lucky to be part of a five colleges, and I hope it remains a five college consortium for those of you who are thinking about Hampshire. Anyhow, but that's how we try and cover some curricular gaps. Yeah.
Well, could you speak about
Now that's interesting. So we were caught by total surprise about Hampshire College's difficulties. And the president on downwards had no idea that this kind of change was going to happen at Hampshire. That was a total shock to the system. What's it?
I'm sorry.
So Hampshire College in January announced that by February 1st it would make a decision about whether or not to admit a first-year class because its financial situation was so dire, and it made and it said that it was seeking a partner. And without that announcement, both that it was seeking a partner, that it was not financially viable, and that it would not seek a first-year class, was a shock. And so things at Hampshire have really spiraled. Next year, it is anticipated that enrollments at Hampshire College will be about 600 students. This year, it's about 1,100 students. So Hampshire is basically halving itself and halving its faculty. So from the Amherst end, you know, Hampshire is an independent institution. We, no one asked us to help save Hampshire, or no one from Hampshire asked us to help save Hampshire, and we are not in a position to help save Hampshire. So what we did at Amherst was, at least I was most concerned about those Hampshire faculty. And so what we told the faculty at Amherst College, some of whom were saying, well, why don't we just hire people, you know, from Hampshire? It's like, well, we can't just hire people from Hampshire. We don't have the lines, and we may not have the curricular interest to hire people from Hampshire. So what I told the Amherst College faculty was a whole bunch of you have, departments have visiting lines that were still open. So this announcement came sort of in February. And while our tenure lines were largely full or very advanced, the searches at that point, there were many visiting faculty positions open. In addition, some departments have restricted funds. And I told departments that have restricted funds, if you would like to spend them on having a Hampshire faculty member, be my guest. So what has happened is 26 Hampshire faculty found positions at other institutions in the Valley. They are all on leave from Hampshire, and half of those, 13 of those, are at Amherst. That's a lot of Hampshire faculty members here at Amherst. I'm actually very proud of the fact that we've been able to help out colleagues, but again, none of it was charity. These individuals all competed in often national searches. We picked up some amazing educators and incredible computer scientists. One of the foremost math educators in the country is coming here. So we have been very, very lucky in that we had the right lines open and were able to hire those Hampshire faculty members. In terms of what Hampshire's, you know, it were Hampshire to close, I think a loss for us is Hampshire students. Hampshire students are different than Amherst students. They're just different. And you can feel it in your classroom. And so what we are losing if Hampshire doesn't continue or doesn't continue in the same way is having those kind of, you know, they're quirky at some level, or they have interesting sort of intellectual views. We're missing that in our classrooms. We are also, in some ways, some of those Hampshire students are actually helping keep enrollments in our humanities classes robust. So one of the losses is if the Hampshire students go away, you know, then we will have some smaller classes, which it's better to have, you know, it's better to have a good-sized class, not too big a class, and not too small a class. So that's the Hampshire story, and we don't know what's going to happen. Right now, they have an interim president. I understand they are just they have formed a search committee for a new president, and I wish them all the best, and I hope we remain a five-college consortium. Yeah. Yes.
Required under some interpretations of it. In my limited knowledge of it, it looked to me like something that could be used as an invitation to begin discussion over what sorts of words can be hurtful and what they mean and so on and so on. But some people interpret it much, much worse than that. And I'm wondering what the reaction was on campus from students and from faculty to that. Whether or not that thing should have ever was it ever meant to appear publicly? I don't think so.
Right. So you're referring to the Common Language Guide that got sent out in an all-campus email. It was prepared by the Office of Diversity and Inclusion. It was intended, it was very well-meaning in its intention. It was intended, at least at its start, to kind of provide information about vocabulary and terms used to identify particular groups of students, both but the terms that those students often find the way they want to be identified. So the intention of the Common Language Guide was in some ways very good, and had it been posted on some site like, various multicultural resource centers at the college, no one would ever have paid any attention, and the resource would have been there and the information out there for students who were interested in looking at it. Because it was sent in an all-campus email and appeared to have the imprimatur of the college as sort of an official guide, the president, who did not know that this was happening, almost immediately withdrew it, which I think was a very appropriate move, because we don't want people to think that at Amherst we tell people how what to think, right? In other words, we don't want people to think that if you're at Amherst College, capitalism means X, when, you know, thousands and thousands of books on capitalism have been written. So that was sort of the problem, was that it appeared to almost shut down conversation around certain terms or give a highly politicized interpretation of certain terms. Probably the problem with the Common Language Guide was that it started with good intentions, and had it stayed in a relatively small format for its original purposes, namely, talked about how different identity groups wish to see themselves identified, what kind of vocabulary is appropriate, this wouldn't have been a problem. When it started to interpret other broader terms in highly charged vocabulary, that then became a problem. So the response on campus was very mixed. Some people thought that the president did the wrong thing and that she shut down conversation. The document is actually widely available. Biddy, Martin, you know, we circulated it to all faculty. We've circulated it to many staff. It's easily available online because it lives online in various places. So the conversation could continue, but we felt in the administration that it was important that a document like that not have the imprimatur of the college. Some students were quite dismayed by the president's decision and felt like this was an attempt to shut down marginalized individuals, underrepresented individuals on campus. That was not in any way the president's intention. And so I think people were worried, oh, are the people who wrote the guide going to be fired and that sort of thing. And none of that has happened, but of course, and nor should it happen, but of course students didn't know. And so part of it was a kind of wanting to protect the people who were involved in this, who are in many ways much loved on campus. I believe a very few students were involved in doing some of the research around the terms, but not huge numbers. And one of the things that has been considered, should students work on this document further? Maybe not this document, maybe another kind of document. So there are those kinds of conversations that are also ongoing. So it's a good question. It was an interesting spring. Many things happened as a result of that common language guide being being distributed. Among other things, there's a direct connection to that and the invitation by the Amherst College Republicans to Jeff Sessions coming to campus. We had Jeff Sessions at campus. I think it's hard to imagine how the event could have gone better in the sense that he was here. Whoever wanted to hear him could hear him, and then he left. And so there was a rally that was respectful on the other side of campus. There were parties and sort of community gatherings staged in other places on campus. So it ended up being a pretty good evening for Amherst College, and I think we're proud that that went pretty well. Yeah. Yes. I disagree that even really good high schools, you might write one 20-page paper over the time in your high school, but not a lot more than that. So I think that students are not so well prepared for that kind of an assignment. Well, I think that you may have gone to a really good high school, and so not all high schools are like that. And it's amazing how many students can go through Amherst College, frankly, and not write a 20-page paper until their junior or even senior year. That is not, it's surprising. So students often say, oh my God, I never wrote such a long paper before. Yeah?
Yeah.
So, of course, we don't, or it's hard to do. That's why I like the metric about academic standing, because we can actually show that over time, many fewer students have been, are now on academic warning during the first year. What we know is that students run into problems later on in their time at Amherst, and so now what we're trying to think about is interventions to, just as we've done now in the first year, are there interventions that we can do in the second year or beyond? Your question, though, is about how do we really measure what it is that we're teaching? And I don't have a good answer to this question because the answer is really 30 years down the line. 30 years down the line, how successful were individuals? How well did they put their Amherst education to work? Any kind of tests that you would give to students at Amherst College, any sort of national standardized test, they'd be in the 99th percentile as seniors and perhaps in the 98th percentile once they were at Amherst for a while. So it's very hard to kind of measure this sort of thing. We're working on it. I don't know, Jesse, do you want to say anything or not really?
Hi, I'm the Director of Institutional Research. We've done several things over the years. We've tried writing portfolio projects, which it's easy to write a rubric. It's really hard to use a rubric to evaluate people's writing. We've done the CLA, which several years ago made a bit of a splash for being a the gold standard of learning. We had the same problem. The first years were in the 99th percentile. The seniors were like in the 98th because we just couldn't get them to show up, and they were writing their thesis and they didn't care. We have worked on the first year seminar, which really is intended to be a writing-centric and reading-centric course. We've done work with the first year seminar committee to evaluate those courses. So we're trying a lot of things, but good writing is easy to recognize, but hard to measure.
Let me just say one thing. So the one thing that I would say is we see a difference over 4 years, and we see these amazing student theses coming out at the end, or we can see over time how this happens. I hope parents are seeing something. I'm amazed what Kenyon's doing with my son over, 3 years, and I imagine that there are many parents who can see the intellectual evolution of their children, but it's very hard to measure in any measurable way.
Right. And a lot of people on the upper end
get ignored as a result. So Amherst remains very challenging even for those students at the top of their classes. This is not an easy school for anyone. So I think we pay a lot of attention to students at the top and all the way through, sort of, at all levels. Yeah. So thank you for raising that, and the Black Studies curriculum is unusual in how strong it is, and that has also played a role in having a good number of Black Studies majors because it's such a rigorous curriculum. So there is some talk. The individual who helped establish that program in Black Studies has unfortunately passed away, but before he did, he sort of conveyed some of this to in a formal program to other faculty members in other departments. So what we're seeing is many departments are trying new things in order to make their curricula more robust around writing. And again, it's starting with some of the introductory classes being smaller so that you could spend more time with students and writing.
Can I follow up a little bit on that? I come from the Berkshires, and I'm sure you know the foment on the Williams campus from minority students and the exodus of many minority faculty. Are things okay here?
I think things are okay here, but we are always concerned. Fortunately, no underrepresented faculty have left in a couple of years, but certainly some have left in recent years, but not very recently. I think we're very lucky in that we have a president who's very attuned to these kinds of issues and is able to speak very eloquently about them to students, to faculty, and to alumni. And I think she's very proactive when she thinks there could be a problem in talking with the students, talking with the different groups. We've been very actively engaged with the Asian American students, for example, to try and channel their frustration into sort of productive lines. So I think we're doing a pretty good job, but I don't want to, promise anything because, Amherst could always be the next headline. We hope we're not, but you never know. Yeah.
So I
don't think there's anything to deny. We do recruit athletes to come to the college. About a third of our students are varsity athletes, and they come here because they are both extremely talented students and they are very good athletes. So you can't get into Amherst unless you have that basic, you know, the SAT scores that are appropriate. Oh, I see. It's your definition of what a superior student is. There are many different ways that a student is superior. But I think we're not interested in having a college of students, all of whom have 1,600 SAT scores. We are interested in having a range of students who are all academically talented, who are all able to make the most of the Amherst curriculum, and beyond that, bring other things to the community. It could be athletic prowess. It could be international experiences. It could be coming from underrepresented groups defined in many different ways. So we believe that the best education is one that takes place with a large variety of students. And athletes are part of that. And I think that the experience of athletes at the college is pretty amazing. And they actually give back a lot to the college while they're here on campus. They are involved often in many other things besides athletics. And, you know, they're great in their own ways. They have incredible work ethics. They really know how to manage their time, et cetera. Yeah. The only thing that we have is a so-called inside-outside program where usually one faculty member per semester teaches a class in the Hampshire County Jail. And in that class, about half of the students are Amherst College students who go over in vans and have to be checked and go through a lot of security in order to get into the prison. And then the class takes place in the prison with also inmates. For the inmates, they have to be on good behavior. I've actually been to at least one of the sort of end of semester presentations by these students, and I actually couldn't tell which ones were the Amherst College students and which ones were the prison inmate. It was really interesting. Some of those students were, you know, in some cases I could tell, but in some cases, like, really? So very interesting. And we are hiring new faculty members who are really interested in that program. That helped to kind of recruit a new philosophy professor. When she learned about that program, she was way more interested. Yeah? Yeah. So we have, I should have said, there's a faculty director, Jill Gensler, a professor of philosophy, who over the past two decades has really learned a lot about pedagogical practices. She, in turn, has helped to hire the director of the Center for Teaching and Learning and the STEM specialist who works in that department. Both of those full-time sort of pedagogical designers, associates, whatever you want to call them otherwise, have PhDs, one in psychology and one in, I believe, theater. So these are very well-educated individuals, but they've also done a lot of work to kind of figure out best practices. Both of them were professors at other institutions at some point along the line, along their career trajectory, and decided that they were just even more interested in kind of working with faculty on pedagogy than they were in being in the classroom themselves all the time. And so they have chosen to come to Amherst in order to pursue this kind of a career. I think there's always a question from faculty members about, well, are best practices in the field, best practices at Amherst College? We are such an unusual place. Our students are so unusual. So that's a frequent conversation. And we don't force anyone to use the Center for Teaching and Learning. It is a resource there that is available for faculty if they choose to use it. And my sense is it tends to, it's many younger faculty want to use the Center for Teaching and Learning, older faculty often less so, but not exclusively. It's not exclusively generational. So I'm looking at the Center for Teaching and Learning. I always want to improve it, see how we can make it better. And we're hoping to, you know, make it an even more effective center over time. Yeah?
The reality seems to be that there are many more multiple majors today than there was back in my day. And
what day was your day? Class of 69? Okay. Okay.
And the combination of the open curriculum and the options uncertainty about where demand and interest will be in the student body. And you mentioned that STEM is on the rise. There's a desire to add more lines in that area. Inevitably, though, you've got a logistical lag effect in trying to catch up with where the demand is, and interest will fluctuate. It may be in STEM now, and in 15 years, maybe it'll be back to psychology. Is there concern about the logistical impact of so many degrees of freedom?
So there's a little bit of a concern of, you know, you're hiring all these math professors, but what about in 15 years if there aren't any more, there's not much more interest in math? One of the things that we do is we hire visitors to cover demand. So while we've doubled the number of math professors more or less, we also had, I believe, 5 visitors in math this year. So you know, the demand for some of these things well exceeds the ability of our tenured faculty to cover it. I think there's a long-term question about some of the humanities lines. I hope none of them have to shrink. None of those departments need to shrink. But I think there's a question about whether we should be growing that part of the curriculum right now. And so those are the kinds of conversations, though, that take place within the CEP, the Committee on Educational Policy, that allocates those lines, and more broadly among the faculties. It's a good, I mean, it's something I think about all the time and worried about.
Catherine,
oh, I have to, oh, one more? Okay, we get the last one. So 45, all right, 45%, I was going to say 40%, but all right, 45% of students study abroad. Almost all of them study abroad in their junior year. Unfortunately, many more of them study abroad in the spring than in the fall, so we're trying to figure out ways to get students to study abroad during the fall. What do we do to support them? We actually recently went to a new model where we are charging our homeschool tuition for students studying abroad, and then we'll pay whatever the program provider, whatever the costs are. That's partly so that students aren't making a decision based on cost, but it's also, it gives us more, a little bit more leverage over those students while they're away. So, but we have a, you know, a terrific Office of Global Studies. Office of Global Education, and they keep very close tabs on all of those students abroad. We have very good relationships with the programs where we send students. You have to go to an approved program. You can apply to go to a not approved program, but then we do a lot of research to make sure that that program is a good program. Is it perfect? No. I think it's safe to say that many students, when they study abroad, have a less rigorous experience abroad, but they are getting other things that may not be a bad thing. So, and very few students study abroad for a year, so it's generally a semester-long phenomenon. I don't want to keep you from anything. I know there are tons of good programs out there today, so I hope that you have a great day. At least you've got great weather today, so thank you.